Shri Yuktswar's melodious voice was calling. I took a look at my cherished cauliflowers and stowed them neatly under my bed. Come, let us go to the beach. Master led the way, several young disciples and myself followed in a scattered group. Our guru surveyed us in mild criticism. When our Western brothers walk, they usually take pride in unison. Now, please march in two rows, keep rhythmic step with one another. My guru's seaside hermitage at Puri. A steady stream of visitors poured from the world into the hermitage tranquility. A number of learned men came with the expectation of meeting an orthodox religionist. A supercilious smile or a glance of amused tolerance occasionally betrayed that the newcomers anticipated nothing more than a few pious platitudes. Yet their reluctant departure would bring an expressed conviction that Sri Yuktswar had shown precise insight into their specialized fields of knowledge. My guru always had young resident disciples in his hermitage. He directed their minds and lives with that careful discipline in which the word disciple is etymologically rooted. Halt! My guru's eyes sought mine. Did you remember to lock the back door of the hermitage? I think so, sir. Sri Yuktswar was silent for a few minutes, a half-suppressed smile on his lips. No, you forgot, he said finally. Divine contemplation must not be made an excuse for material carelessness. You have neglected your duty in safeguarding the ashram, you must be punished. I thought he was obscurely joking when he added, your six cauliflowers will soon be only five. We turned around at Master's orders and marched back until we were close to the hermitage. Rest a while. Mukunda, look across the compound on our left, observe the road beyond. A certain man will arrive there presently, he will be the means of your chastisement. I concealed my vexation at these incomprehensible remarks. A peasant soon appeared on the road. He was dancing grotesquely and flinging his arms about with meaningless gestures. Almost paralyzed with curiosity, I glued my eyes on the hilarious spectacle. As the man reached a point in the road where he would vanish from our view, Sri Yuktswar said, now, he will return. The peasant at once changed his direction and made for the rear of the ashram. Crossing a sandy tract, he entered the building by the back door. I had left it unlocked, even as my guru had said. The man emerged shortly, holding one of my prized cauliflowers. He now strode along respectably, invested with the dignity of possession. The unfolding farce, in which my role appeared to be that of bewildered victim, was not so disconcerting that I failed in indignant pursuit. I was halfway to the road when Master recalled me. He was shaking from head to foot with laughter. That poor crazy man has been longing for a cauliflower, he explained between outbursts of mirth. I thought it would be a good idea if he got one of yours, so ill-guarded. I dashed to my room, where I found that the thief, evidently one with a vegetable fixation, had left untouched my gold rings, watch, and money, all lying openly on there, the cauliflower robbery, blanket. He had crawled instead under the bed where, completely hidden from casual sight, one of my cauliflowers had roused his single-hearted desire. I asked Sri Yuktswar that evening to explain the incident which had, I thought, a few baffling features. My guru shook his head slowly. You will understand it someday. Science will soon discover a few of these hidden laws. When the wonders of radio burst some years later on an astounded world, I remembered Master's prediction. Age-old concepts of time and space were annihilated, no peasant's home so narrow that London or Calcutta could not enter. The dullest intelligence enlarged before indisputable proof of one aspect of man's omnipresence. The plot of the cauliflower comedy can be best understood by a radio analogy. Sri Yuktswar was a perfect human radio. Thoughts are no more than very gentle vibrations moving in the ether. Just as a sensitized radio picks up a desired musical number out of thousands of other programs from every direction, so my guru had been able to catch the thought of the half-witted man who hankered for a cauliflower, out of the countless thoughts of broadcasting human wills in the world. The 1939 discovery of a radio microscope revealed a new world of hitherto unknown rays. Man himself, as well as all kinds of supposedly inert matter, constantly emits the rays that this instrument sees, reported the Associated Press. Those who believe in telepathy, second sight, and clairvoyance, have in this announcement the first scientific proof of the existence of invisible rays which really travel from one person to another. The radio device actually is a radio frequency spectroscope. It does the same thing for cool, non-glowing matter that the spectroscope does when it discloses the kinds of atoms that make the stars. The existence of such rays coming from man and all living things has been suspected by scientists for many years. Today is the first experimental proof of their existence. The discovery shows that every atom and every molecule in nature is a continuous radio broadcasting station. Thus, even after death, the substance that was a man continues to send out its delicate rays. The wavelengths of these rays range from shorter than anything now used in broadcasting to the longest kind of radio waves. The jumble of these rays is almost inconceivable. There are millions of them. A single very large molecule may give off 1 million different wavelengths at the same time. The longer wavelengths of this sort travel with the ease and speed of radio waves. There is one amazing difference between the new radio rays and familiar rays like light. This is the prolonged time, amounting to thousands of years, which these radio waves will keep on emitting from undisturbed matter. By his powerful will, Master was also a human broadcasting station, and had successfully directed the peasant to reverse his steps and go to a certain room for a single cauliflower. Intuition is soul guidance, appearing naturally in man during those instants when his mind is calm. Nearly everyone has had the experience of an inexplicably correct hunch, or has transferred his thoughts effectively to another person. The human mind, free from the static of restlessness, can perform through its antenna of intuition all the functions of complicated radio mechanisms sending and receiving thoughts, and tuning out undesirable ones. As the power of a radio depends on the amount of electrical current it can utilize, so the human radio is energized according to the power of will possessed by each individual. All thoughts vibrate eternally in the cosmos. By deep concentration, a master is able to detect the thoughts of any mind, living or dead. Thoughts are universally and not individually rooted. A truth cannot be created, but only perceived. The erroneous thoughts of man result from imperfections in his discernment. The goal of yoga science is to calm the mind, that without distortion it may mirror the divine vision in the universe. Radio and television have brought the instantaneous sound and sight of remote persons to the firesides of millions, the first faint scientific intimations that man is an all-pervading spirit. Not a body confined to a point in space, but the vast soul, which the ego in most barbaric modes conspires in vain to cramp. Very strange, very wonderful, seemingly very improbable phenomena may yet appear which, when once established, will not astonish us more than we are now astonished at all that science has taught us during the last century. Charles Robert Richer, Nobel Prizeman in Physiology, has declared. It is assumed that the phenomena which we now accept without surprise, do not excite our astonishment because they are understood. But this is not the case. If they do not surprise us, it is not because they are understood, it is because they are familiar, for if that which is not understood ought to surprise us, we should be surprised at everything. The fall of a stone thrown into the air, the acorn which becomes an oak, mercury which expands when it is heated, iron attracted by a magnet, phosphorus which burns when it is rubbed. The science of today is a light matter. The revolutions and evolutions which it will experience in 100,000 years will far exceed the most daring anticipations. The truths, those surprising, amazing, unforeseen truths which our descendants will discover, are even now all around us, staring us in the eyes, so to speak, and yet we do not see them. But it is not enough to say that we do not see them, we do not wish to see them. For as soon as an unexpected and unfamiliar fact appears, we try to fit it into the framework of the commonplaces of acquired knowledge, and we are indignant that anyone should dare to experiment further. A humorous occurrence took place a few days after I had been so implausibly robbed of a cauliflower. A certain kerosene lamp could not be found. Having so lately witnessed my guru's omniscient insight, I thought he would demonstrate that it was child's play to locate the lamp. Master perceived my expectation. With exaggerated gravity he questioned all ashram residents. A young disciple confessed that he had used the lamp to go to the well in the backyard. Sri Yukteswar gave the solemn counsel, seek the lamp near the well. I rushed there, no lamp. Crestfallen, I returned to my guru. He was now laughing heartily, without compunction for my disillusionment. Too bad I couldn't direct you to the vanished lamp, I am not a fortune teller. With twinkling eyes, he added, I am not even a satisfactory Sherlock Holmes. I realized that Master would never display his powers when challenged, or for a triviality. Delightful weeks sped by. Sri Yukteswar was planning a religious procession. He asked me to lead the disciples over the town and beach of Puri. The festive day dawned as one of the hottest of the summer. Guruji, how can I take the barefooted students over the fiery sands? I spoke despairingly. I will tell you a secret, Master responded. The Lord will send an umbrella of clouds, you all shall walk in comfort. I happily organized the procession. Our group started from the ashram with a satsanga banner. Designed by Sri Yukteswar, it bore the symbol of the singular eye, the telescopic gaze of intuition. No sooner had we left the hermitage than the part of the sky which was overhead became filled with clouds as though by magic. To the accompaniment of astonished ejaculations from all sides, a very light shower fell, cooling the city streets and the burning seashore. The soothing drops descended during the 2 hours of the parade. The exact instant at which our group returned to the ashram, the clouds and rain passed away tracelessly. You see how God feels for us, Master replied after I had expressed my gratitude. The Lord responds to all and works for all. Just as he sent rain at my plea, so he fulfills any sincere desire of the devotee. Seldom do men realize how often God heeds their prayers. He is not partial to a few, but listens to everyone who approaches him trustingly. His children should ever have implicit faith in the loving kindness of their omnipresent Father. Sri Yukteswar sponsored 4 yearly festivals, at the equinoxes and solstices, when his students gathered from far and near. The winter solstice celebration was held in Serampore. The first one I attended left me with a permanent blessing. The festivities started in the morning with a barefoot procession along the streets. The voices of 100 students rang out with sweet religious songs, a few musicians played the flute and klakatal, drums and cymbals. Enthusiastic townspeople strewed the path with flowers, glad to be summoned from prosaic tasks by our resounding praise of the Lord's blessed name. The long tour ended in the courtyard of the hermitage. There we encircled our guru, while students on upper balconies showered us with marigold blossoms. Many guests went upstairs to receive a pudding of chana and oranges. I made my way to a group of brother disciples who were serving today as cooks. Food for such large gatherings had to be cooked outdoors in huge cauldrons. The improvised wood-burning brick stoves were smoky and tear-provoking, but we laughed merrily at our work. Religious festivals in India are never considered troublesome, each one does his part, supplying money, rice, vegetables, or his personal services. Master was soon in our midst, supervising the details of the feast. Busy every moment, he kept pace with the most energetic young student. A sankirtan, group chanting, accompanied by the harmonium and hand-played Indian drums, was in progress on the second floor. Sri Yukteswar listened appreciatively, his musical sense was acutely perfect. They are off-key. Master left the cooks and joined the artists. The melody was heard again, this time correctly rendered. In India, music as well as painting and the drama is considered a divine art. Brahma, Vishnu, and Shiva, eternal trinity, were the first musicians. The divine dancer Shiva is scripturally represented as having worked out the infinite modes of rhythm in his cosmic dance of universal creation, preservation, and dissolution, while Brahma accentuated the time beat with the clanging cymbals, and Vishnu sounded the holy mridanga or drum. Krishna, an incarnation of Vishnu, is always shown in Hindu art with a flute, on which he plays the enrapturing song that recalls to their true home the human souls wandering in Maya delusion. Saraswati, goddess of wisdom, is symbolized as performing on the veena, mother of all stringed instruments. The Samaveda of India contains the world's earliest writings on musical science. The foundation stone of Hindu music is the ragas or fixed melodic scales. The six basic ragas branch out into 126 derivative raginis, wives, and putras, sons. Each raga has a minimum of five notes, a leading note, Vedi or king, a secondary note, Samavadi or prime minister, helping note Sainyuvadi, attendants, and a dissonant note, Vivadi, the enemy. Each one of the six basic ragas has a natural correspondence with a certain hour of the day, season of the year, and a presiding deity who bestows a particular potency. Thus, one Mahindo raga is heard only at dawn in the spring, to evoke the mood of universal love. Two, deeper karaga is played during the evening in summer, to arouse compassion. Three, megaraga is a melody for midday in the rainy season, to summon courage. Four, Bhairavaraga is played in the mornings of August, September, October, to achieve tranquility. 5. Sri Raga is reserved for autumn twilights, to attain pure love. 6. Malkansa Raga is heard at midnights in winter, for valor. The ancient Rishis discovered these laws of sound alliance between nature and man. Because nature is an objectification of Om, the primal sound or vibratory word, men can obtain control over all natural manifestations through the use of certain mantras or chants. Historical documents tell of the remarkable powers possessed by Mintan Sen, 16th. Folklore of all peoples contains references to incantations with power over nature. The American Indians are well known to have developed sound rituals for rain and wind. Tansen, the great Hindu musician, was able to quench fire by the power of his song. Charles Kellogg, the California naturalist, gave a demonstration of the effect of tonal vibration on fire in 1926 before a group of New York firemen. Passing a bow, like an enlarged violin bow, swiftly across an aluminium tuning fork, he produced a screech like intense radio static. Instantly the yellow gas flame, 2 feet high, leaping inside a hollow glass tube, subsided to a height of 6 inches and became a sputtering blue flare. Another attempt with the bow, and another screech of vibration, extinguished it. Century court musician for Akbar the Great, commanded by the emperor to sing a night raga while the sun was overhead, Tansen intoned a mantra which instantly caused the whole palace precincts to become enveloped in darkness. Indian music divides the octave into 22 sruti sordi semitones. These microtonal intervals permit fine shades of musical expression unattainable by the Western chromatic scale of 12 semitones. Each one of the 7 basic notes of the octave is associated in Hindu mythology with a color, and the natural cry of a bird or beast do with green, and the peacock, re with red, and the skylark, me with golden, and the goat, far with yellowish white, and the heron, sol with black, and the nightingale, la with yellow, and the horse, si with a combination of all colors, and the elephant. 3 scales major, harmonic minor, melodic minor are the only ones which Occidental music employs, but Indian music outlines 72 thatas or scales. The musician has a creative scope for endless improvisation around the fixed traditional melody or raga. He concentrates on the sentiment or definitive mood of the structural theme and then embroiders it to the limits of his own originality. The Hindu musician does not read set notes. He clothes anew at each playing the bare skeleton of the raga, often confining himself to a single melodic sequence, stressing by repetition all its subtle microtonal and rhythmic variations. Bach, among Western composers, had an understanding of the charm and power of repetitious sound slightly differentiated in 100 complex ways. Ancient Sanskrit literature describes 120 tilas or time measures. The traditional founder of Hindu music, Bharata, is said to have isolated 32 kinds of tala in the Song of Alak. The origin of tala or rhythm is rooted in human movements, the double time of walking, and the triple time of respiration in sleep, when inhalation is twice the length of exhalation. India has always recognized the human voice as the most perfect instrument of sound. Hindu music therefore largely confines itself to the voice range of 3 octaves. For the same reason, melody, relation of successive notes, is stressed, rather than harmony, relation of simultaneous notes. The deeper aim of the early Rishi musicians was to blend the singer with the cosmic song, which can be heard through awakening of man's occult spinal centers. Indian music is a subjective, spiritual, and individualistic art, aiming not at symphonic brilliance but at personal harmony with the oversoul. The Sanskrit word for musician is Bhagavath-ah, he who sings the praises of God. The Sankirtans or musical gatherings are an effective form of yoga or spiritual discipline, necessitating deep concentration, intense absorption in the seed thought and sound. Because man himself is an expression of the creative word, sound has the most potent and immediate effect on him, offering a way to remembrance of his divine origin. The Sankirtan issuing from Sri Yukteswar's second story sitting room on the day of the festival was inspiring to the cooks amidst the steaming pots. My brother disciples and I joyously sang the refrains, beating time with our hands. By sunset we had served our hundreds of visitors with khichdi, rice and lentils, vegetable curry, and rice pudding. We laid cotton blankets over the courtyard. Soon the assemblage was squatting under the starry vault, quietly attentive to the wisdom pouring from Sri Yukteswar's lips. His public speeches emphasized the value of Kriya Yoga, and a life of self-respect, calmness, determination, simple diet, and regular exercise. A group of very young disciples then chanted a few sacred hymns. The meeting concluded with Sankirtan. From 10 o'clock until midnight, the ashram residents washed pots and pans, and cleared the courtyard. My guru called me to his side. I am pleased over your cheerful labors today and during the past week of preparations. I want you with me. You may sleep in my bed tonight. This was a privilege I had never thought would fall to my lot. We sat a while in a state of intense divine tranquility. Hardly 10 minutes after we had gotten into bed, Master rose and began to dress. What is the matter, sir? I felt a tinge of unreality in there, the cauliflower robbery, unexpected joy of sleeping beside my guru. I think that a few students who missed their proper train connections will be here soon. Let us have some food ready. Guruji, no one would come at 1 o'clock in the morning. Stay in bed, you have been working very hard. But I am going to cook. At Sri Yukteswar's resolute tone, I jumped up and followed him to the small daily used kitchen adjacent to the second floor in a balcony. Rice and dal were soon boiling. My guru smiled affectionately. Tonight you have conquered fatigue and fear of hard work, you shall never be bothered by them in the future. As he uttered these words of lifelong blessing, footsteps sounded in the courtyard. I ran downstairs and admitted a group of students. Dear brother, how reluctant we are to disturb Master at this hour. One man addressed me apologetically. We made a mistake about train schedules, but felt we could not return home without a glimpse of our guru. He has been expecting you and is even now preparing your food. Sri Yukteswar's welcoming voice rang out. I led the astonished visitors to the kitchen. Master turned to me with twinkling eyes. Now that you have finished comparing notes, no doubt you are satisfied that our guests really did miss their train. I followed him to his bedroom a half hour later, realizing fully that I was about to sleep beside a godlike guru. Chapter 16. Outwitting the Stars. Yukunda, why don't you get an astrological amulet? Why should I, Master? I don't believe in astrology. It is never a question of belief. The only scientific attitude one can take on any subject is whether it is true. The law of gravitation worked as efficiently before Newton as after him. The cosmos would be fairly chaotic if its laws could not operate without the sanction of human belief. charlatans have brought the stellar science to its present state of disrepute. Astrology is too vast, both mathematically and philosophically, to be rightly grasped except by men of profound understanding. If ignoramuses misread the heavens, and see there a scrawl instead of a script, that is to be expected in this imperfect world. One should not dismiss the wisdom with the wise. All parts of creation are linked together and interchange their influences. The balanced rhythm of the universe is rooted in reciprocity, my guru continued. Man, in his human aspect, has to combat two sets of forces first, the tumults within his being, caused by the admixture of earth, water, fire, air, and ethereal elements, second, the outer disintegrating powers of nature. So long as man struggles with his mortality, he is affected by the myriad mutations of heaven and earth. Astrology is the study of man's response to planetary stimuli. The stars have no conscious benevolence or animosity, they merely send forth positive and negative radiations. Of themselves, these do not help or harm humanity, but offer a lawful channel for the outward operation of cause-effect equilibriums which each man has set into motion in the past. A child is born on that day and at that hour when the celestial rays are in mathematical harmony with his individual karma. His horoscope is a challenging portrait, revealing his unalterable past and its probable future results. But the natal chart can be rightly interpreted only by men of intuitive wisdom, these are few. The message boldly blazoned across the heavens at the moment of birth is not meant to emphasize fate, the result of past good and evil, but to arouse man's will to escape from his universal thraldom. What he has done, he can undo. None other than himself was the instigator of the causes of whatever effects are now prevalent in his life. He can overcome any limitation, because he created it by his own actions in the first place, and because he has spiritual resources which are not subject to planetary pressure. Superstitious awe of astrology makes one an automaton, slavishly dependent on mechanical guidance. The wise man defeats his planets, which is to say, his past, by transferring his allegiance from the creation to the Creator. The more he realizes his unity with spirit, the less he can be dominated by matter. The soul is ever free, it is deathless because birthless. It cannot be regimented by stars. Man is a soul, and has a body. When he properly places his sense of identity, he leaves behind all compulsive patterns. So long as he remains confused in his ordinary state of spiritual amnesia, he will know the subtle fetters of environmental law. God is harmony, the devotee who attunes himself will never perform any action amiss. His activities will be correctly and naturally timed to accord with astrological law. After deep prayer and meditation, he is in touch with his divine consciousness. There is no greater power than that inward protection. Then, dear master, why do you want me to wear an astrological bangle? I venture this question after a long silence, during which I had tried to assimilate Sri Yukteswar's noble exposition. It is only when a traveler has reached his goal that he is justified in discarding his maps. During the journey, he takes advantage of any convenient shortcut. The ancient rishis discovered many ways to curtail the period of man's exile in delusion. There are certain mechanical features in the law of karma which can be skillfully adjusted by the fingers of wisdom. All human ills arise from some transgression of universal law. The scriptures point out that man must satisfy the laws of nature, while not discrediting the divine omnipotence. He should say, Lord, I trust in thee, and know thou canst help me, but I too will do my best to undo any wrong I have done. By a number of means, by prayer, by willpower, by yoga meditation, by consultation with saints, by use of astrological bangles, the adverse effects of past wrongs can be minimized or nullified. Just as a house can be fitted with a copper rod to absorb the shock of lightning, so the bodily temple can be benefited by various protective measures. Ages ago, our yogis discovered that pure metals emit an astral light which is powerfully counteractive to negative pulls of the planets. Subtle electrical and magnetic radiations are constantly circulating in the universe. When a man's body is being aided, he does not know it, When it is being disintegrated, he is still in, outwitting the stars, ignorance. Can he do anything about it?